This is special coverage from WBUR Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. The gurus of American history aren't in the classroom, they're in the bookstore. Americans are infatuated with popular history, snatching engrossing tales of yore off the shelves as fast as they can be printed. But the recent literary Donnybrook over Stephen Ambrose's plagiarized prose begs the bigger question. Do popular histories do more to educate or to entertain? Do the feel-good sensibilities of bestseller histories accurately reflect the events and people they chronicle? And how do these red-hot books influence America's understanding of itself? Tonight we're stalking the literary line of popular history. Join the conversation at 1-800-423-TALK. That's 1-800-423-8255. With us now from New York is Mark Lewis. He's a staff writer at Forbes.com and has covered the ongoing story of Stephen Ambrose's alleged plagiarism. In today's Wall Street Journal, Mark Lewis wrote an op-ed piece entitled "Don't Indict Popular History." Welcome, Mark Lewis.
Hi, Tom. Nice to be here.
It's good to have you. And joining us from the studios of Vermont Public Radio is special coverage news analyst Jack Beattie, a senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly magazine. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom.
Mark Lewis, you've laid out the kind of range here. You've looked at both the plagiarism. You've uncovered a lot of it yourself. But today in the Wall Street Journal, you say, don't indict popular history. It's all the history we've got. Describe to us how you fluctuate between those poles.
Well, the Ambrose situation obviously is a juicy story.
Sure.
And it's remarkable. I've been, since the Weekly Standard broke the story with the first book, I've looked at four more. There's an awful lot of whole chunks of prose he's kind of shoveled in or even edited in from certain sources. I can't say how many sources. I've only looked at a couple. But the interesting thing is he footnotes the passages, and then he often fulsomely thanks the authors in an introductory note along with his other acknowledgments. So this is kind of a venial sin, I would say.
So is that giving credit or is that no shame?
It's somewhere in between. And it's hard to see. His own reaction has been kind of mixed, and I expect we'll get a fuller statement at some point. But on one hand, he apologized with the first book. I said, "Gee, I wish I hadn't done it." I'll put quotes in the future editions.
Mm-hmm.
Then, as more came out, he sort of retreated to I'm just trying to write an stirring narrative here, and we footnote everything. We don't really want to bore people, the average reader, with this kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And clearly, that's what he wants to do as a writer of lively narrative history. You don't want the stuff to be filled with chunks of kind of ham-fisted attribution. The problem is, of course, you're supposed to rewrite this stuff into your own words. If you put footnotes, the assumption of the reader is still that the actual words are your own,
yeah.
And they're not going to read a tasty passage and look to the footnotes to see who actually wrote it. They assume Ambrose wrote it.
And even so, we hate to throw stones because we've all, you know, laid back on the beach or the sofa at home and dived into Stephen Ambrose's books and just had wonderful, wonderful journeys.
I've read several myself.
In certain circles, who hasn't?
Mm.
But then the other thing you point out is the kind of cheerful, triumphalist tone of these books. Is that a concern to you, Mark Lewis? Do you feel like we're getting the real deal here? Or if Stephen Ambrose is willing to lift passages to make these books, is he also willing to put a rosy gloss on American history of some kind to bring those readers in and make them happy?
Certainly he is. I should say that there's two issues here, really. I mean, on one hand, there's an assumption that Ambrose has started to do this, perhaps corrupted under the pace of his blockbuster bestseller a year that he's been producing since about 1994.
They do come out one after another.
Since 1994, and he's been doing this. But the thing is, see, he's been doing this for 30 years in terms of production, so this is not, although that was the immediate journalistic reaction, it must be the lure of Hollywood dollars and his huge advances, and he wants to keep the bestsellers coming.
Mm-hmm.
But he's been producing books at something close to this pace virtually since he started writing books in 1962.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the books that I looked at that had this pattern went back to, was in 1975, so clearly it's not a response to the lure of Simon & Schuster and or Steven
mm-hmm.
Spielberg demanding that he provide more product. But the another issue, as you suggest, is, and this is certainly more, he is an academic historian himself, of course, but other academic historians and just plain critics, I suppose, have to some extent raised questions about the triumphal tone of his more recent books, which again has kind of fallen into this whole Greatest Generation thing.
Right.
Which, and he, I believe, says that he has, that's part of what he's been trying to do is to let people take pride in the accomplishments of the recent past.
And, I mean, Americans manifestly cannot get enough of that.
We can't,
and love to read it. Is there something wrong with that, or is that just a well-deserved pat on the back for the greatest generation?
Well, I'd say, there's what's wrong with it or not wrong with it is, to some extent, it's set on one hand by the marketplace, and on the other hand by the climate of opinion within Ambrose's peers. The marketplace loves it, and the marketplace, I would say, ought to get what it wants, and it is. At the same time, Ambrose is, you know, he's got a PhD, he taught for years, he's a serious historian, or certainly he used to be, in terms of the books he wrote, and he, I presume, cares about the opinion of his peers, and that is what, would determine whether these books are well thought of in a critical sense, and I would say that they're, if the critical opinion is negative, that does not invalidate the mass audience opinion. Mm-hmm. I mean, they should be able to buy books that may not pass muster with the critical opinion if they want to.
How does our hometown sweetheart here in Boston and Pulitzer Prize winner Doris Kearns Goodwin fit into this picture?
Well, at this point, it's a little hard to say. I mean, I haven't reported on this so much as I've been following it and what she's been saying. Apparently, this is, so far at least, restricted to her first book. I'm sorry, not her first book, but her first huge bestseller book, and I think she's only produced, I think, about four books. So she does not crank them out.
And this was the 1987, the Fitzgeralds and the Kennedys.
And the Kennedy. Mm-hmm. However, it, from what I understand, it sounds very similar in that she reproduced copious passages, she says inadvertently, and I have no reason not to believe her, from her notes. She said she got mixed up with her notes, and one of the authors at least apparently registered a complaint, and she actually settled with her in some undisclosed terms, and what she did was add footnotes, but that only brings the Fitzgeralds and the Kennedys up to the situation that Ambrose is currently being criticized for, which is he footnotes passages, but the words aren't necessarily all his own. However, it's hard to say with Goodwin. At this point, it's one book, and she certainly seems to have dealt with the authors involved, or at least one of the authors.
Mark Lewis, dive with us into how this sausage is made. We love consuming it, but if this is a pattern that shows up among any number of authors, is there something about the way these popular histories are put together that lends itself to this treading the fine line?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, if you're a serious historian, that's a loaded term, but if you're a purely
scholarly
academic historian, mm-hmm. and you're only writing for your peers. Mm-hmm. You don't have to worry about a dramatic point-to-point narrative, and you don't have to worry about sticking in footnotes that may slow down the flow of, you know, probably if you're a post-structuralist or something, you probably don't even believe in the flow of copy, and that's not a problem. If you're writing for the mass audience, they want stories well told, mm-hmm. and the trick is that, and of course, this is somewhat analogous to journalism, and we face this in journalism. Mm-hmm. The trick is you got to assimilate the material, a whole bunch of material, a mass of material, give credit where credit is due, and yet minimize credit, because the more credit that you give, the more you're going to slow down this narrative, because it's not going to feel like a story. It's going to feel like a pill that someone is swallowing. So at the very least, when you borrow from and everyone must lean. Serious historians as well as popular historians must lean on previous sources.
Of course, that's the nature of the historical
Absolutely.
Tradition.
There's no way to get around that. Mm-hmm. But the trick is, I mean, apart from direct quotes, which you, of course, can borrow from someone else and footnote, if you're borrowing information as you must, you've got to put it in your own words. Mm-hmm. And no one's going to mind if you pick up boilerplate, like, one of the Ambrose books was one of his Nixon things, which I was looking at, and he borrowed a lot of copy from a book by Robert Sam Anson, who is a journalist and currently a contributing editor at Vanity Fair, not a, you know, his quote-unquote serious historian. But if he borrowed phrases like Nixon returned to San Clemente in 1974, no one would care. But he borrows more vivid language and maybe changes a word or two.
Your larger point is, and you make it today in the Wall Street Journal, that for all that, we're darn lucky to have these books. And a nation that spends a lot of time staring at Britney Spears' navel, it's a lucky thing when we get writers like these and David McCullough who can get us to read about John Adams for 750 pages.
Absolutely. That's the perfect example. Or Edmund Morris is currently, after his controversial insertion of himself into the Reagan biography Dutch, is a return to what he does best, which
with Teddy Roosevelt.
With Theodore Rex, the second volume is Roosevelt. And he does a wonderful job. These people, of course, spend years crafting this stuff, which may be the Ambrose situation. But someone like McCullough, I mean, his book, popular serious historians will quibble, and I think have, with aspects of it. It's too pro-John Adams, too simplistically anti or not sufficiently recognizing Jefferson's contributions, or maybe he got this or that fact wrong, all of which must be brought forward and presumably dealt with by the McCulloughs of the world. But the point is, the mass audience will not ever get anything about John Adams apart from what David McCullough, who could imagine the bestseller about John Adams or Harry Truman?
We're talking tonight about popular history. Do you read popular history? Who doesn't? Is your faith in Stephen Ambrose or Doris Kearns Goodwin shaken by these recent stories that have come out? What is popular history? Is it just big selling, or is it popular because it doesn't have standards? You can join our conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. Jack Beatty, what do you hear in this debate over the place of popular history? We all read it. We all love it. So what's the problem?
Well, I think the problem is the market calculation that goes into it. With Ambrose, for example, he clearly calculated, as has just been said, that putting quotation marks in the flow of a story will break the rhythm of the story. Well, he defends that by saying the public doesn't want that kind of thing. That's like saying the public doesn't want truth. It doesn't want accuracy. It doesn't want the candor of history. And
is it really? I mean, is the truth really diminished for a non-scholarly audience? Just because, even if it's just blatantly, the prose has been blatantly double used, does it make the truth less, or is that just, quibbling over form?
I don't think it's quibbling over form. History should be about trying to get it right, and that means getting it right even in the paint you use, even in the means you use. And if your means are fouled like that, you're pretending someone else's work is your own, then how can you be telling any larger truths? I mean, historians have an office. We do look up to them. We recognize they've wrestled with questions. They've taken all the courses we didn't want to take. And they've thought through things. And we do give them a real sort of charisma in this society. They're authorities. And I just think it's abusing that authority when these people simply say, look, I'm a storyteller. I need to... That is just, I don't know. I find that in a way, that's a kind of, negative, rancid populism. Oh, they couldn't stand for any of this. I mean, it is dismaying to say the least.
Well, we take your point, and yet, how many footnotes do you want on that page at the beach? In a popular democracy, without popular history, would we have any history at all, Mark Lewis?
Well, you don't want a whole lot of quotes, or certainly the mass audience may not. But the point here is, not to lose the point, he didn't have to take the words. It's just a matter of rewriting them, the material, into his own words, which he didn't do, which people that take more time with their books generally do. I don't know what the situation was with Goodwin and Fitzgerald and Kennedy. It sounds like that may have been a one-time thing. I don't know. But the pace that Ambrose presents, and we may find out in the weeks to come, more and more of this may come out, and my God, well, I'll go, none of them write their own books. I mean, they're all taken from Herodotus. Who knows? But with Ambrose, at least, no one's putting a gun to this guy's head saying he's got to put out a book a year. And I repeat, this goes back way before his bestseller days. It's internal. He wants to do books he wants to get these things out. And I've never written a book, and I'd like to write a book. And I'm finding, I've struggled with one for years, and it's hard. And I've always admired people like Ambrose and Mr. Beatty that get their books out. But perhaps Ambrose is at some point in the past just kind of took himself to a level of production that was beyond what. I agree. This will not stand. I said it was venial, not mortal, but it's important. He should have rewritten it into his own words, and he could. It's not like you can't do it.
And he certainly got the skill, but it's a bridge too far. Mark Lewis, thanks so much for joining us.
You're welcome.
Mark Lewis is a staff writer for Forbes.com. His column was in today's Wall Street Journal. We're talking about popular history, how it's made, how the sausage is made, and the picture it presents of America. What do you think? This popular history is thrilling, but is it honest? Is it true? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. You're listening to Special Coverage from WBUR Boston.
from Boston.
This is special coverage from WBUR Boston. We're talking tonight about popular history. We all read popular histories. Many, most of us, I dare say, love them. Yet there's been all the plagiarism charges that have tumbled out in recent weeks. And tonight we're asking something even beyond that. Is there a rosy hue, or as Mark Lewis calls it, is there a triumphalist tone to popular history that tends to bend it just a little bit? What will we read when we read the histories of the opening salvos of the War on Terror after 9/11? Or what did you think when you saw Black Hawk Down, the movie that takes off on the book of the same name? Join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're joined now by Robert Dalek. He's a professor of history at Boston University. He's written two biographies of Lyndon Baines Johnson, Lone Star Rising, Lyndon Johnson and His Times, 1908 to 1960, and Flawed Giant, Lyndon Johnson and His Times, 1961 to 1973. It was a notable book of the year in 1998, selected by the New York Times Book Review. He's currently working on a biography of President John F. Kennedy. Good evening and welcome, Robert Dalek.
Thank you.
Thanks for being with us.
Sure.
Take us first, if you would, into this question of how popular history is made. And I'd be interested how you characterize your own history. But how's the sausage made? Is there a system that tempts out of bounds behavior?
Well, the writing of history is a craft, and it's something that something that you learn over many years. It's a lot of hard work, especially if you're doing modern history, mm-hmm. where there's such massive documentation, and requires a kind of discrimination as to what you're going to focus on. What I find interesting is that so much of this talk about popular history is related to entertainment, as we're discussing it this evening. And popular history, serious history, whatever you want to call it, is history that has an impact, has an influence. Mm. For example, you have studies that demonstrates Lyndon Johnson's deviousness, his credibility gap during the Vietnam War. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people have read both my volumes. And what I think they come away with from reading about Johnson is a certain suspicion of government, perhaps. It creates a certain skepticism, a certain criticism. And it's teaching something. It's creating a certain understanding of the way in which the government works.
As well it should, and doesn't popular history do that as well? Would you call your histories popular histories, Robert Dalek?
I would say they straddle. They're between two worlds. Mm-hmm. On the one hand, they have gotten significant sales, and they're out in books on tape, and the mm-hmm. second volume had...
The whole shebang.
Pardon?
The whole shebang.
Yeah, and it's... But on the other hand, they are... Very substantial scholarship. I spent 7 years doing each of those books, and I like to think they're highly respected in the scholarly community. But I get back to this point that, and I think you're quite right, of course popular history shapes understanding and has an influence on the way in which people think about our culture, about foreign policy, about our presidents, about politics. And so historians have a heavy responsibility there.
Well, if that's true, can you then describe, is there some consistency to the filter that popular history puts on American history?
Well,
what's the coloring that it tends to bring?
I think it depends on the time you're talking about. For example, Richard Hofstadter, who was really one of the great historians of the 20th century, wrote a book called The American Political Tradition and the Men Who Made It.
Mm-hmm.
That book has probably sold close to 1 million copies in paperback since it was first published in 1947 or 48. And it's had a huge impact, I think, because it was sold in honors courses in high schools and many college courses. Now, that book wasn't celebratory about America. It was debunking. And he has struck resonant chords mm-hmm. in this country because people find debunking history very appealing also. So, there's not simply one genre of popular history. There is, of course, the kind of thing that Steve Ambrose does so very well, which is to strike responsive chords about the excellence of America's tradition and mm-hmm. the greatness of the country. But there are also those who, look at the enormous success that all the debunking books on Kennedy have had.
So does the debunking and the glorious light all balance out in the end? Is this just fine?
I think it depends on the period of history you're in. Sometimes debunking is more popular, and at other times the celebratory is more popular, and we go from one to the other. And I think what's crystal clear is nobody has a monopoly on truth or wisdom as to the country's history, because all these elements are a part of it. And what I say is the more the merrier. I mean, it's an enterprise that the more people pursue it, the more people write, the more people read, I think the better it is. Now, this is not to say that we should just get slovenly, poorly done history. I think a historian's obligation is to try, and as Jack Beatty was saying before, your objective is to get as close to the truth as you possibly can without being arrogant about the idea, oh, yes, I have the revealed word, because none of us do. And that's why history is always being rewritten. There was a great Dutch historian by the name of Peter Gale who said that history is argument without end. And I think there's an awful lot of truth to that.
Jack Beatty, you've written The Rascal King, widely praised biography of Boston's infamous and beloved mayor, James Michael Curley. What did you learn dipping your toe in that pond?
Well, I think what I learned, and by the way, hello to Bob Dalek. I think what I learned was the temptations that writers are under. I mean, you want people to read something and to enjoy it, and you don't want to lard it up, and you don't want to, you know, cumber the paragraphs with citations. On the other hand, and so I was tempted to sort of tell the legend of James Michael Curley, but I thought I was reacting against that. A novelist, Ed O'Connor, in The Last Hurrah had given us the legend. And I wanted to take the legend and I wanted to take the man and put him back into history. And that required, you know, a very different procedure than just to simply tell a story. I had to analyze. I had to step into the narrative and say, on the one hand, on the other hand, I had to, you know, come to judgments about things and not just let it be a story, because I wanted to put him in history. And what I realized, of course, is that history is that. It is a field of complexity. And that the romancers of history, I think, leave that out to tell the tale. They leave out what we know about ourselves, our families, our friends, just how complicated, how cussed, how difficult we are. And, you know, and they leave all that out. And they also leave out the question of why, of cause, of analysis.
And yet, Jack, legend tells so well by the fireside.
Well, yeah, I guess. But, you know, J.H. Plum, the British historian, years ago wrote a book called The Death of the Past. And he says that's what the past is. It's legend. Yeah. And he says the past has been used really by ruling classes to support authority. The legends of the past have tended to just kind of support whatever the authority said. And he said, you know, in modern times, history, that is to say the search for what really happened, has killed the past. History is the enemy of the legend, of the ruling class myth. And I think that's a very good office for a historian to have.
Well, that's a liberating thing.
To be the enemy of the legend and to try to reconstruct life as it was.
Let's turn to the phones. A lot of callers would like to chime in on this. Dave is on the line. Welcome, Dave. You're on the air.
Hi, how are you?
Thank
you
so much. We're well, thanks. Sure.
I just wanted to call in defense of people like Mr. Ambrose who—
Stand up for it, yeah.
I mean, I like his work very much, and I think one of the things that he does for popular history is to really make it easily digestible for younger people. I think that they shy away from the heavy history book that obviously are, you know, probably a lot of research, a lot of good work has gone into it, but I think that it's made it a good vehicle for younger people to even get into history, even sort of ease them into it.
And Dave, you don't sound like such a kid, but it does sound like you're a fan.
I am a fan, and I'm not such a kid. I wish I was.
when you hear the reports of Stephen Ambrose having plagiarized, does it matter to you?
I have to. Yes, it does matter to me. It is of concern to me, because I think what your guests have pointed is that they. It's important that we learn history in the correct way, that the attribution, attribute, the quotations and the people who
sure.
said why it's important. But I think that when I read through Ambrose's volumes, I feel like I am getting some of that because I know that he went through extensive interviews with people and has made me want to read more, and I have wanted to go on and read more of the heavier stuff.
We all know that feeling, Devin. We thank you for your call. Robert Dalek, let me put it to you. Here's the question we asked earlier was, in a popular democracy, without popular history, would we really have any history at all?
Well, you want popular history, and I think your call is quite right, that you do want to reach young people and interest them in the country's history. But, you know,
well, and let's not pretend. There's an awful lot of adults, millions, who read and love these, myself included.
Sure, but there are an awful lot of millions of people who are ignorant of the country's history, and I'm always appalled by these polls that are done about 18-year-olds who can't distinguish the decade in which the Civil War occurred or World War I. But I think we should, I would like to emphasize that I don't think accurate or reasonably accurate history is mutually exclusive with popular history.
Mm, bravo.
I think, you know, good popular history can be accurate history, or at least as close to the truth as one can get. But I think Jack Beatty makes an excellent point that when you get into this kind of work, the tension he describes is so on the mark. You don't want to write this for some small, obscure audience.
Sure.
You want to reach people with what you're writing. You spend a lot of sweat doing it. But on the other hand, you don't want to compromise yourself by distorting. And so there's a kind of constant tension that you face. But if you produce first-rate history, I think it can be popular history as well. And I think there's a tradition of doing that. I think, by and large, that Doris Kearns Goodwin has done very well.
Mm.
I think, you know, her book on the Roosevelts, on the Roosevelt era.
An Ordinary Time.
Yeah, I think that's a fine piece of work. And and I think generally Fitzgerald's and Kennedy's is very well done, too. And it has a kind of analysis to it. And also, I think Jack's book is a first-rate book. So, you know, and I think it reached a certain audience. So I don't think the two are mutually exclusive.
Robert Dalek, stand by. I want to bring in Chris Lehman. He's senior editor for the Washington Post's Book World section, calling in from Washington. Good evening, Chris Lehman.
Good evening.
Chris Lehman, describe for us, from your view, watching the river of books go by, what's the impact of popular history on our overall access to history?
Well, I think it's interesting. I'm just listening to a lot of what Jack Beatty was saying. I definitely second, you know, I think it has a sort of quiet and insinuative impact on the way we understand the past,
how so?
Well, you know, as L.P. Hartley famously said, the past is another country. They do things differently there, and you have to understand that there's, you know, there are radically different issues and personalities and conflicts that impinge upon every historical era, and that's part of the challenge of what. And I agree that all history should be made accessible to general readers, but it also needs to challenge the imaginations of readers.
So what are you suggesting? Do you see popular history as having an effect of eroding this somehow?
Yeah, I think, you know, Bob Dalek, you know, reiterates the need for popular history and underscores the need as well for that popular history to be critical. And when he was talking, I was thinking of the historians that influenced my own study of the discipline, people like Richard Hofstadter, who is a very eminent very popular and extremely critical historian who, you know, was kind of falsely credited with creating the consensus school of historiography, but was really a very, you know, measured, thoughtful debunker of received historical opinion. Also, my advisor in graduate school, Christopher Lash, who studied with Hofstadter, among others. And I think, you know, those are people who reached very, very large audiences and had, you know, they weren't sort of revisiting tried and true tales of heroism or greatness, as is the increasing historical category of description these days.
Well, what about that? When Stephen Ambrose and David McCullough mount the bestseller list, as they do time after time,
right,
what's the impact on other kinds of history,
well,
on history that's less narratively thrilling?
I think, in sort of crass market terms, it gets squeezed out. I think you see a lot more of the kind of books that, say, Richard Hofstadter would have written go into university presses, where they are less, you know, they sell less well, and as a consequence, are not perhaps edited as well. And so you have this kind of, you know, vicious circle where we say, oh, no one's writing for a popular audience, but no one's out there trying to make the market that you know, makes history sellable to a popular audience.
And yet, here are these big names that are certainly writing for a popular audience.
Sure, and as you know, others have been saying, they you know, will substitute legend for truth, or, you know, just reassure. That's my main concern, is that what we have now in our popular history is a history of reassurance. And I think history in all periods should be challenging people to think differently about our world and the forces that shaped it.
Chris Lehman, that's a great point.
Interject,
yes, Jack.
Hofstadter himself spoke to this in the preface to his book, The American Political Tradition. He was looking back at the Americana writing of the 30s and Carl Sandburg and that sort of thing, and he spoke of the increasingly passive and spectatorial interest in history. He said, these histories induce a desire to observe and enjoy, not to analyze and act.
Exactly. The analysis, I think, is essential. And a lot of what we now receive as popular myths, say the image of Patrick Henry, and Andy Burstein writes about mm-hmm. this very effectively in his book, American Jubilee,
and if I could,
was entirely a creation of popular historians of the age.
You know? Robert Dalek, I hear you there.
Yeah, if I could say a word for maybe what's best described as more strictly academic history, you know, this has an impact too. It may not at times reach a large audience, but ideas are important. And for example, a lot of the work on women's history, on the study of African Americans, mm-hmm. was really pioneered in universities. These weren't books that were done by people who were instantly getting on bestseller lists, but they did an awful lot of work to incorporate these other groups into the country's history and make us think about the fact that we had been looking at our past in too narrow a frame. And now it's really accepted wisdom that you've got to teach courses on women's history and African-American history and a much broader kind of history than we ever had before. And a lot of this is growing out of the ideas that came in universities first. So, you know, they cross over into the popular mind. And it's not easy to chart exactly how that happens, but people can do some pretty, I wouldn't want to say unpopular history, but history that doesn't reach a broad audience, and yet it can have in the long term. Mm. A large impact.
Chris Lehman, just 20 seconds before the break, what's the trend here? More history of reassurance or something else?
In popular terms, certainly the trend is history of reassurance. And I was going to say in response to Bob's point, you wind up, you know, to me, Joe Ellis was the subject of an earlier scandal not relating to his scholarship. But I thought what was interesting was that, you know, prior to that scandal, Ellis reversed himself on the question of Thomas Jefferson fathering a child with his slave Sally Hemings. And, you know,
Chris Lehman, we've got to take a break. Sure. Hang on. We're talking about popular history. Do you love it? Do you hate it? You probably love it. This is Tom Ashbrook in special coverage from WBUR Boston. This is special coverage from WBUR Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about popular history, the books we love to read like popcorn that open our eyes to a lot of the past and maybe to just a bit too much rosy hue, some of our guests are saying tonight. What do you think? Do you read popular history? In a popular democracy, without it, would we have any history at all? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. We're joined by Robert Dalek, professor of history at Boston University and author of two highly acclaimed biographies of LBJ, and right now by Chris Lehman. He's a senior editor at the Washington Post's Book World. Chris Lehman, we know we're going to lose you in just a moment, but do you have any sense of whether Americans read history differently from the readers in any other country? Do all countries have the same kind of love affair with the popular historical view of the past?
Well, I think, you know, that's a very big question. I wouldn't presume to speak authoritatively on it. My sense is that you know, a certain kind of nostalgia does fuel popular nationalism and creating a popular, you know, what your guests have been referring to as a mythic kind of history is a stage along that path. And I think, you know, it's a mark of maturity when, you know, a country's citizenry can then look critically at that past, and as Bob Dalek was saying earlier, to fill out some of the stories that have not been told. And it seemed like one of the paradoxes in what Bob was saying was that, you know, in some ways, we have a situation now where the broader the readership, you have a steady narrowing of the critical history being done. Mm-hmm. And that's sort of the paradox that I think anyone who cares about history wrestles with all the time.
Chris Lehman is senior editor of the Washington Post's Book World section. Chris, thanks for joining us tonight.
Thank you.
We have a lot of callers who want to join us. Let's turn to them. Sharon is on the line. Welcome, Sharon. You're on the air.
Thank you.
Sure.
I'm speaking from the viewpoint of a reader, and I'm in the middle of a wonderful literary biography. It is replete with an exhaustive index and footnotes and a great bibliography, and I regard those things as wonderful adjuncts to the text.
Who's the biography of,
it's
Sharon?
Peter Ackroyd's The Life of Thomas More.
All right.
I can't put it down. It's 406 pages long, and I want to read it all in one sitting.
Have you read some of the other historians we're talking about tonight, Stephen Ambrose?
Yes, I have.
You won't find perhaps as many footnotes there. Which do you prefer, or do you care?
I think the more the merrier. I like to have as much information as possible. I mean, it's there for the taking. I don't have to use it, but if I become curious about the source of a quote and I want to know more about the person who originally said it, at least I have a direction to go in.
Sharon, thanks for your call. Robert Dalek, here's a reader after your own heart, but is Sharon the profile of the bestseller-creating American reader?
Well, maybe not exactly the profile, but she says something which I think is awfully important. She wants to have confidence that what she's reading is reasonably accurate and authoritative. And I think in the long run, any historian worth his or her salt is going to want to persuade their audience that what they've done is a fine history. And I think that's the greatest failing with Steve Ambrose, and not that he...
You're saying it's inaccurate?
No, well, not that he intentionally went out and appropriated people's words that he didn't quote accurately or left behind the fact that he was quoting. He's been so quick to produce so much, and it takes a lot of hard work, and you have to go a bit more slowly. And in a sense, it's unfortunate because I think it undermines his credibility.
It's a brand name we want to trust. Anne is on the line. Welcome, Anne. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi.
I teach a lot of students who are writing, and I've written popularly and somewhat academically. And I guess one of the things I think needs to get added, I think we've confused a lot of issues here. I mean, there's problems with bad popular history and good popular history. There's obviously history that should raise critical questions and does or doesn't.
But, we're taking on a lot at once. We'll grant you that.
Exactly. But the thing that I think is interesting that I find with students today as opposed to even 5 years ago is that there's so much stuff you can download and copy in, and you know, you can put so much writing of other people into your own writing.
Got it. Anne, your radio in the background is hurting our ears here, but we got your point. Let me put it to Bob Dalek. You must see this all the time. Technology makes copying very simple.
Well, it does, and it makes you a bit disquieted when you get the student papers, and is this really the product of their own work? And you want to believe that your students are playing honest pool with you, but this kind of technology, I think, is a temptation to lots of young people out there.
And Shannon is on the line. Welcome, Shannon.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Good to have you.
This entire debate about the scholarly history versus popular history reminds me of the debate about journalism versus creative nonfiction.
Okay. In what regard, Shannon?
Well, it just reminds me of, you know, you think of books like Midnight in the Garden of Good and Evil.
Yes.
And Dutch a couple of years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And the questionable kinds of techniques that those writers used in order to convey a true story. And then there are other writers such as John McPhee and Tracy Kidder, Joan Didion. And so it seems to me that there's a spectrum.
So your point is there are many ways to get at truth, or?
Well, just that I don't think there's any definite line that marks, you know, okay, on the right here we have truth, and on the left that's all fiction. It seems like that there's a spectrum, and that the decision of how useful it is, it really depends ultimately on the individual reader and the individual reader's needs. And that for some people, they're just out for a good story. And so that might be fine with them. But if you might not turn to Ambrose now for, you know, one of your sources for your dissertation.
But you'll certainly turn to him when you want that good read. Shannon, thanks for your call. Robert Dalek, there you hear it, the kind of postmodern anchor being
mm-hmm.
lifted.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it doesn't matter.
Well, I think it does matter in the sense that there are degrees and degrees, and there are standards. And when you're in graduate school as a PhD student in history, you're taught that you quote accurately and that you provide references that are accurate. And also, you're candid about what you're doing. If you're producing historical fiction, then you should say that's what it is. And so I think there need to be standards that you don't simply take everything and swallow it whole and say it's all just perfect. There are degrees and degrees, and that's why some histories stand up over 100 years, and some fall by the wayside. So there are standards that people apply, and I think that's all well and good.
We're all for that. Robert Dalek is author of two wonderful biographies of Lyndon Johnson, and it has soon a new biography coming out on President John F. Kennedy. Robert Dalek, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Sure, my pleasure.
Jack Beatty, there you are. No one imagines that we're going to stop reading these histories, and they surely have opened many people's eyes to many facets of American history that they simply wouldn't have been aware of otherwise.
Oh, that's certainly true. And we all like a terrific narrative, and Ambrose is especially good at telling a story. But, you know, if people like a narrative history, have them look at David Kennedy's Freedom from Fear. He tells a great story about the American people in the Depression and war without scanting a single complexity of it. And he moves the narrative along, deals with counterargument. That's history as story and as knowledge.
Ah, Jack, once again, you show us how to have it all. Jack, thanks for joining us this hour.
Thank you.
Listeners, you can continue this conversation online. Go to WBUR.org and click on Special Coverage Forums. Once the favorite target of late-night talk show monologues, President Bush has been largely off-limits to comedians in America since September 11th. But the president has been lampooned daily in the pages of India's largest newspaper since the war on terror began. Since early October, the Times of India has run a daily satirical comic strip called W-Man. The strip portrays the president as a caped superhero, long on muscle but short on just about everything else. I asked W-Man's creator, Jugsuriya, what was behind the creation of the character.
When what the world is calling 9/11 took place, and when I watched it on television, I was absolutely appalled at what had happened, and I was very grief-stricken. However, when President Bush began to respond to this, his immediate response sounded to me like a combination of sort of Rambo and Arnold Schwarzenegger and, you know, I'm going to go and smoke him out. I'm going to, you know, you're either with us or for us. And I began to wonder, terrorism is a terrible thing.
Yes.
It's a horrible thing. But was George W. Bush, was he trying to solve the problem, or in his rather aggressive way, was he going to contribute to this problem? I mean, here's America, unarguably the most powerful nation in the world. And here's the man who's the leader of America, who is, by all accounts, and before 9/11 happened, he's not exactly an Einstein. He's not exactly a brain box. So I thought of this idea of a superhero like Superman, Batman, all these superheroes, which were created in America, but a superhero slightly deficient in the brain department, and that's how W-Man was born.
And so you brought W-Man to the pages of the Times of India. Give us a sense of the kind of adventures that W-Man has been on in the pages of your newspaper.
When it started, obviously, it was, you know, what was happening, the hunt for Osama bin Laden, who incidentally still hasn't been caught.
We noticed that.
Yeah. And then the so-called war against terrorism, which really meant dropping a whole lot of bombs along with food supplies on Afghanistan, which had already been completely sort of reduced to rubble by the Taliban and was just adding to that poor, unfortunate country's woes. Then my publishers in the Times of India said, hey, listen, you know, this thing is over. And I said, no, it's not. It's just begun, because this universal campaign against terrorism that Dabia or WMN has launched, unfortunately, involves India as well, because Afghanistan is in our backyard. We've got Pakistan as a neighbor, and as you know, relationships between India and Pakistan haven't been of the happiest.
And so you sent WMAN off on a lot of encounters. The table in front of me is covered with copies of the cartoon, and it's a caped crusader, George W. Bush, with a big W on his chest, getting into all kinds of hijinks and proving himself invariably a fairly perfect moron. He decides to send an anthrax-laced letter to Osama bin Laden, and when it's pointed out that they don't have his address, he says, let's email it. He hears from India's prime minister that Enron has been cooking the books, and he says, well, books have always been pretty difficult for me to digest. Well, maybe it's a good thing to cook them. I mean, this is a moron.
That's a frightening thing about it, because he is a superhero, because he's got super muscle, but unfortunately he's got less than a super brain.
What is the response to the cartoon been from your readership, Jogsarya?
A lot of people hate WMN, not just Americans, but Indians. A significant amount of people like the cartoon strip. India is really hoping, now we're getting into politics, but India is hoping that with American interest coming more towards India's side, America or Washington will help India solve this problem of Kashmir. I don't quite look at it that way, because I think that America, being an intelligent country, will look after American interests, as indeed it should, and India must look to its own interests. We can be friendly, sure, of course, but I don't think that New Delhi should look to Washington to solve its own problems or to clean out its own backyard.
You've written that black humor is the hiss of the safety valve on the pressure cooker. What's the pressure that's building up in India in its attitude toward the United States?
Not towards the United States so much as towards Pakistan. This has been a problem which has been there for more than 50 years, and it revolves around Kashmir. You can't even talk about a solution to Kashmir and everyone starts flying at everyone else's throat. And I felt that some element of humor, of satire, should be introduced, because a lot of very, very serious things can be said under the guise of humor or satire. And I think that we need to do this.
In your column, it looks like today, off the very latest news out of India, there's the Indian Prime Minister, Vajpayee, I guess, is saying, if those terrorists in Calcutta were attacking the American center, how is it that they shot only Indian policemen? And WMAN shows up to say, what's the difference? Aren't all you guys working for me these days?
Right.
To which the Prime Minister thinks in response, if we are, how about paying us American salaries? There's always that mismatch of circumstances between America and some of its allies in Asia.
We shouldn't forget that there are a lot of economic, cultural, and social differences, not just between India and America, but between America and this part of Asia. Eventually, Asians or any people in any part of the world have to find their own answers.
Jogsarya, how long will WMAN keep flying in the pages of the Times of India?
As long as the situation warrants.
Jogsarya is a columnist for the Times of India, where his comic strip WMAN appears daily. To read installments of WMAN, visit our website at wbur.org and click on Special Coverage. I'm Tom Ashbrook. You're listening to Special Coverage from WBUR Boston.
This is W.